Hello, everyone. Welcome to Distillery Sessions, the podcast from Distillery. My name is Peter Hoffer, and I will be your host for today's Distillery Session. And today I am joined by Andrew Weber, founder and CEO of Human Theory. And today we are talking about AI, insights, and fandom. So, Andrew, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me, Peter.
No, my pleasure. It's really great to have you on here and being able to talk about this topic, which I think lots of people, you know, may know the terms, but not necessarily what it's all about. So it's really great to have you here.
Great.
So maybe if we could just kick off with learning a bit more about you and what Human Theory is all about.
Yeah, definitely. So I've been in around marketing and data in marketing for about 13, 14 years now, both client side, agency side. I've worked on CRM, worked with creative agencies. I've worked in digital agencies as well, all with a kind of a different view of how we can use data to make the offering better and, I guess, build better relationships with customers and prospects. So I've been running Human Theory now for about 2.5 years. And yeah, ultimately it was set up straight after leaving a major creative agency, partly because I just wanted to do something on my own and be a bit more in charge of like the day to day. But yeah, I really wanted to explore the use of language and how AI can help us understand that at kind of a mass scale and how that could be turned into some interesting insights, because I felt that was an area that was yet to be fully explored and utilized by a lot of the kind of marketing world.
Okay. So I guess what was, you know, with your interest in language and analyzing that, you know, prior from you, you know, starting Human Theory, what was that type of analysis like when it came to language? Is it more of, you know, positive, negative sentiment, or is it even a bit more cruder than that when it came to language?
Yeah, I think the sentiment was something that that was quite freely used, and people were aware of things like that. I think the proliferation, I should say, of social listening platforms and things like that, I guess, brought kind of Twitter data and things like that into the public domain, but also particularly from an advertising marketing point of view. Planners and strategists got to really understand the volume of data that was there and how to access it. I think I got to feeling when I was looking around at some of the platforms that they would give you fairly rudimentary answers. And I think my personal view is that the limitation with SaaS platforms is that in order to make them a SaaS platform, they have to make it one size fits all. And I think you often lose some of the nuance and the ability to customize when you do use a SaaS platform. So I think sentiment and perhaps some broad analysis of things like that was being done. But I think if you are able to use AI to analyze hundreds of thousands of conversations and interactions and things like that between people, there's a lot more data there than was being used. Yeah. So that was really one of the reasons why I really wanted to explore data, language data, and kind of what that nuance could tell you about someone's emotions and wants and needs.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I guess it makes sense where, you know, if you ask a specific question at the data, you will get a specific answer, but you may not see that, you know, the gray area where a lot of the rich insights maybe going. It sounds like that's what you know, AI and particularly what you're doing at Human Theory is, you know, taking it one step further.
Yeah, I think what I was most interested in was trying to use the scale that AI enables you to actually make some of the insight that was used from a brand or a creative point of view a bit more robust and frankly a bit more actionable. So mm-hmm. we do something that we call qualitative insight at quantitative scale. So we look for that nuanced kind of qual style insight, but we do it at a mass scale. So we'll be looking for those kind of nuggets of insight and nuggets of information that you might get from speaking to a small group of people, but we'll be looking at what 250,000 people are talking about, and pulling it out from there. So my real ambition was to make sure that we were able to provide the nuance of qual, but actually create that scale that meant that it kind of enables it to be robust, and from there you hope that enables people to be braver with their ideas, because then they're confident that the scale is there behind that insight.
So I'm conscious that we've sort of mentioned AI a few times already, but maybe if we could spend a few minutes to for you to really explain what you mean by AI, and taking that a step forward, how would you explain AI to a marketing director or a CEO?
Yeah, I think this is an area that I think maybe has been driven a bit by the media narrative as well behind AI, that it was coming to take everybody's jobs and that kind of thing. And even if you look back at some movies and things like that, this kind of thought process behind what AI was and what it would do to us. I like to explain it as it's really AI is really it's Johnny Five, not the Terminator. It's there really to help you, not replace your thinking or what you're trying to do. How we use it is we use it to scale human thinking rather than replace it. So, again, in analytics, you often too often have the human element removed from it, but we always make sure that there is a human inside the thought processes directing the thought processes, so that the AI is taking away some of the really rudimentary and monotonous and repetitive tasks. But actually, what that means is the human should be able to therefore spend more time thinking about what they do with the information rather than getting the information in the first place. So, and I guess that then increases how much you can look at and how quickly you can look at it. So, for us, again, to go back to that example, I would rather recommend a strategy to somebody based on, the thoughts of 250,000 people than 12. And as a result, I would also rather that there was a human in the middle of that working out what it meant rather than a SaaS platform that is piping an answer directly back into somebody who maybe hasn't really understood how they've asked the question in the first place. So, I try and make sure that when we're talking to marketing directors or C-suite, that they understand that AI is not something that's there to create mass efficiency in terms of replacing people's jobs. It's just there to make sure that you get access to better information faster, and you can therefore make better decisions. The type of AI that we use is natural language processing, which in kind of layman's terms is mass text analysis. We use public data, open source data on a variety of different topics, all customizable depending where we want to take the data from. And yeah, what we're really looking to do there is, like I say, scale human thought, not replace the thinking that goes into it.
I see. Now, it's really interesting how you mentioned, those cultural touchstones of like the Terminator or, Space Odyssey 2001, of those nefarious robots or technology that would do humans harm. Because I was reading this article ages ago of, detailing the perception of AI and robots from Western culture to Japanese culture. And Western culture is, as you said, the Terminator, versus Japanese culture, which has taken a different approach of including it in healthcare or helping out in old age homes or things like that. So it's really interesting, that culture embedding.
I think we also see that actually in industry as well, which is another kind of reason I wanted to do this was this kind of tribal. I certainly found it in marketing anyway, that there was really this tribal split between the use of data and creativity. And despite what many people will have you believe, it isn't really being used as it should be, and frankly could be. And I just think that that's creating like a quite a chronic lack of empathy between between brands and consumers, because they're not really listening to what consumers want or need. And I think it's really important that that bridge, that gap is bridged, that kind of tribal gap between kind of data and insight and creativity, because I think it connects with people better when it comes from, people's motivations and wants and needs.
Yeah, no, I think, and that's to sit alongside of other perhaps research tools. So I guess could you talk a bit more of how you use AI to really understand human behavior of going beyond just asking direct questions, as we've seen in previous research, for example.
Yeah, I think that's all about the nuance of language. And I think, verbs, nouns, adjectives, pronouns, they all hold real meaning in how people use them. You can tell a lot about somebody's state of mind, but also who they are just by how they speak. That goes as far as their emotional state, but also you can tell things about people's personalities, who they are from a kind of family point of view, based on what they're talking about. And you can really start to get an idea of what different groups are motivated by, but also what their kind of barriers are as well. And I think that's key for us, is helping brands understand, and other kind of partners that we have, helping them understand what the needs are of their particular kind of consumer or customer set, and trying to understand the nuance behind that, right down to the language and the words that they use to describe things. So an example might be that a utility company trying to speak to a specific individual group or audience group, and actually using language that that audience group doesn't use. So, for example, using the term broadband, which doesn't actually connect with how some people talk about broadband. They would use the term internet. And I think we've done a lot of work identifying which kind of groups of people, whether it be by affluence or age or gender, what kind of words actually they use to describe things, and how brands should really talk about their products and their offerings to make sure that the end user even understands that it's there for them. And that's a big part of what we do, is really help brands understand, well, trying to translate really what they are trying to say into something that a consumer would understand and recognize as something they need.
No, that is, because it sort of leads into my next question of perhaps reaching audiences that may be a bit more difficult to reach. So, for example, maybe people who's where English is not their first language, for example, or people who different regional differences or things like that. So, how AI could better help serve understanding these communities rather than corporate speaks, for
Yeah,
example.
and I think that comes down to the same thing really, which is the nuance. And I think we've worked across projects across Europe and Asia as well. And I think the important thing that, again, that is important to us, is that to understand the cultural nuance behind the language, and which is, again, something that you don't get by plugging a SaaS platform into something. It's not so, you can't automate cultural nuance. And if we're working, to use the Japanese example that you referenced earlier, I think if we're working on understanding what a Japanese consumer thinks about, I don't know, fragrances, for example, then we would use a native Japanese speaker, and we would work with different people on our network who speak the right language culturally as well as, fluently. Because I think, again, if you're automating the wrong parts of the process, you lose the nuance, and you get something which gives you what I would call quite flat insight, which by that I mean it's not interesting, and there's not much you can do with it really. So it kind of leads to decisions being made that aren't rooted in insight, because it's not deep enough or nuanced enough to actually help you understand what to do.
Yeah, I guess that's where the richness of the data is, like, are there any, actionable insights from this rather than, oh, that's nice to know for
Yeah, exactly. And
yeah.
we have worked with people like that who, it's really important to them to learn something new. And obviously, it's not always possible to learn something new about something, but at the same time, I
Sure.
think it's part of our, it's part of our role is to find things that maybe it's a new spin or it's how things have changed recently. Obviously, we're in a period of, mass flux at the moment. We're doing a lot of work for people on how things have evolved over the last couple of months and what that might mean for their business. Web chat, for example, something that's had an enormous shift culturally, something that was used primarily for business, but actually is now primarily a social tool. And how are those kind of behaviors impacting how people use it from a work point of view as well? So, we're constantly looking at how things are changing. And yeah, I think it's really important that nuance is able to be you're able to gain that nuance by twisting things around or always looking for new things. And again, that comes from customizing what the questions you're asking and how you're asking them.
Sure. How I guess how adept how robust is the AI when it comes to the shifting tones of language, like anything from slang to new terminology that may come up either from a cultural standpoint, from slang or sarcasm standpoint. How would you go about to ensure that the technology is fully aware of the shifts in human language?
I think that's where it's super important to have a human involved in the process end to end. So the way that we work is we have a strategist and a data scientist who work together, similar to how creatively you might have had a creative pair. We have a pair of differing skill sets that work together, exactly for that reason, really, which is to understand when things are changing. There's new nuances in there that we haven't seen before. And we're able really to kind of timestamp things as well and look at how things have shifted and trends have changed. But yeah, I think as for slang and things like that, AI can't tell you that. The human has to tell you that. And ultimately, sarcasm is a really interesting point as well. And it's the fundamental reason that most sentiment models fall down is they obviously can't tell when you're being sarcastic. And I mean, if you think about the tone of email and text communications versus speaking, often you'll lose the tone and misinterpret a tone that maybe if you're talking to somebody at work over email, or client or whatever that might be, it's difficult to pick tone up. And the AI is no different to that, really, in that it can't always tell you that, from a sarcasm point of view. And again, it for me points back to if you don't have human thought being scaled, human thought part is absent, then you will miss nuance.
Gotcha. I guess that goes back to your previous point of, AI is not eliminating all sort of human endeavor when it comes to this type of thinking, but it's doing the heavy lifting and giving more time, more, I guess, more quality time to for people to do this type of strategy work when it comes to the data that the AI is shifting through.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it's useful for, a lot of mass analysis and, predictive modeling as well and things like that. But ultimately, the AI can't predict the future in the same way that, a human can't predict the future. It will get you better data so that you can perhaps look at trends and how you think they might go. But ultimately, if people sit there and tell you that they have AI that can tell you what the world's going to look like in 2 years, then that's marketing speak. That's not the reality of how it works.
So we've talked a bit about the nuances of language, the shifts of language, but I'll be interested to get your thoughts on emojis. I think with more people feeling more comfortable using smiley faces or thumbs up or thumbs down, and particular younger audiences almost exclusively writing an emoji, of whether AI has addressed that, or is that something that needs to be sort of developed in the future to understand that type of human speak.
No, similarly, you know, it's the same as words, really, in terms of you can analyze it in a mass sense. I think actually analyzing the two together is probably the trickiest part of that. You can separate them apart and you can analyze them, but actually putting the two together and having obviously emojis in with, you know, language, that's where it becomes a bit more complex because you've effectively got two different variables to look at. But yeah, emojis for me actually simplify things a lot because it's effectively taking the nuance out. Somebody using an emoji is, you know, a whole lot of emotion is going into a singular icon often, or a few icons. So it's taken some of the nuance out already. So it becomes a relatively simple, a much simpler exercise. We actually analyzed a food brand were posting content out from their own social accounts, but they were also getting influencers to do it. And we actually looked at what the most common emojis were in reaction to the two different accounts. It's just a really simple exercise. And what was interesting was that when the influencer posted the same content, you got the heart eyes emoji was the most used. And when the brand's account posted it out, exactly the same content, they got the suspicious face was the most common. Now, that might be the brand itself, but it just shows you that, you know, you can put on a singular slide, there's, you know, you can get to a piece of insight pretty quickly there that, you know, you can probably work out what that means. But like I say, it removes a lot of the nuance, but it is obviously doable.
And I guess with something as obvious as those two different emojis, that can, give a lot of rich recommendations to the brand, whether it's to really continue building the trust with the audience, or whether to proceed to invest more in the influencer strategy. So I guess.
Yeah, I think again, you because of the lack of nuance, it kind of can give you a recommendation that's based on, you know, channel strategy or something like that, but it's not going to give you the nuance that you might need from a brand or a creative activation kind of point of view. So yeah, again, it's kind of can be used for different things, and the richness, like you said earlier, that richness will depend how it can be used.
So I'd be interested to get maybe a few examples from where AI and analytics have really helped, shape the way a brand to, better understand its fans, whether it's from, personal experience at Human Theory or things you've seen in the wider industry.
Yeah, I think obviously at the moment, being kind of housebound, there's a lot of flux at the moment in the different industries, and there's a lot of people doing different things at the moment. So it is a time where we're looking very closely at a lot of things, and we're working with quite a few people who are very open to using this type of technique to kind of help them understand their consumers a bit better. So yeah, I think, you know, some interesting stuff we've been working on quite recently actually, for Powwow Now, the conference call and web meeting company, really to understand what people's true emotions are around working from home and the use of web chat, and how, I guess, culturally things have changed, and how that kind of social impact, the social use of these tools has impacted how people feel about them, but also how they want to use them from a work point of view. And then this kind of all important question of what is the new normal, and, you know, whether this is here to stay. And obviously that's an important question for them. But I think what we found very interesting was that it really showed and uncovered a lot of emotion behind the people using web chat, and gave them some really quite important insights, as right down to, you know, content and tone recommendations and what actually would be really helpful, but even UX and things like that. And I think for a brand to take it, you know, I think it's a really responsible thing for a brand to do, is to think, hang on a second, let's really understand what's important to people at the moment, what is a very emotional time. because we want to make sure that we are speaking in a way that reflects how they're feeling. I think a lot of people are quite scared about being tone deaf at the moment, and I think it's why a lot of marketing people are not marketing, because they're scared of the tone that it might kind of come across as. But yeah, I mean, we really love working with PowerNow because they have a bit of a family kind of vibe to them, and because of that, they do really care about their customers and what they want and how they're feeling and things like that. And I think that's allowed us to really look into, well, what does the future of working from home look like actually, and how can PowerNow help really. And I think we've been doing a lot of work on small business owners, but also employees, and how do employees and employers differ in terms of how they view things. And yeah, I think for us that's going to result in some really big, outputs for them from a tonal point of view, but also probably propositionally and positioning wise as well. We also have worked with Jo Malone. This was slightly before the coronavirus hit, but they really want to understand in multiple markets, how do people like to consume different products, and what are the emotional states that go with them. So I think that's something that shows again that it's a brand that's really trying to listen to people. But I think what we're trying to help them with is not just to listen, but to really hear what the consumer wants, and ultimately how they can help make that happen. And to your point, I think you go from being a customer to a fan when you think, oh, this is a brand that really gets me, and really understands my lifestyle and how their products fit into that kind of lifestyle. And rather than, just trying to market their products at me all the time, they're really thinking about, what my life looks like and what's important to me. And I think that's kind of the type of work we really love to do, because it helps to build that empathy gap a little bit. And it does help a brand create fans, because yeah, it becomes an important part to them really. And we've been working a lot in mental health as well at the moment to help brands understand, not brands, but in healthcare and play and things like that. There is a big kind of mental health epidemic that's going to follow this pandemic. So they're very aware of that, and they want to understand again, it's how should we talk to sufferers, and in a way that shows that we understand and we're here to help, rather than going to a marketing agency who sit around and have a chat and come up with an idea. It should be based on what people that need our help are saying. So again, I think mental health is a big area for us that we're doing quite a lot of work in, and that's to help people understand, the nuance between depression and anxiety, and what causes different things, and ultimately how do those people speak, and how does it impact them, and what's the language that they use that helps us understand their mental state. And I think that's really important, that people, particularly when mental health has become, I guess, something that a lot of people have started talking about, I think it's really important that it's done in a responsible way with the suffering, at the center of it, rather than, a few nice Instagram posts and, some kind of flashy design, which I don't think really helps as much as people would like it to think it does.
And I guess to your point of the mental health example of, it's such a personal and sensitive topic that, when you communicate with people, you want to make sure that they are, you're using the terms that they recognize rather than clinical terms. Or for example, I'm sure that men will talk about mental health differently from women. And, again, for targeted messages, you want to, talk just like the communities that you're targeting.
Yeah, and I think for mental health as well, particularly, it's less about targeting, but really making sure that you're putting content or creating content that is there for people, and they recognise that it's there for them. when they need it. And I think that comes from making sure that you're, you know, what you're talking about resonates with them emotionally, but also, you know, in terms of, you know, the reality of what they deal with. And I think that can only come by trying to listen and understand, you know, what to, you know, how does this affect people, and what's the responsible way to talk to them about this?
No, that is a very, very good point. I think, you know, you mentioned the examples of Jo Malone and you know, PowAm now are being quite, you know, forward-thinking organizations that appreciate language and emotion as a way to, you know, better understand and better connect with their fans. But I suppose that listening also can bring up things that a company may not want to hear or be ready to hear. So have you know, encountered examples where, you know, perhaps prospective clients or, you know, other people that you've delivered this data insights to have maybe were a bit less willing to understand what their customers or audiences were saying?
Yeah, I mean, that does come up a lot because I think we pride ourselves on, you know, we're there to have an opinion, a robust opinion. Sorry, my mum just phoned me midway through that, so I just wanted to. Yeah, we're there to have a robust opinion, in both senses of the word robust, really. We pride ourselves on not being afraid to tell somebody something that they may not want to hear. I think it's really important that brands do hear from, you know, what the consumer thinks about something, both good and bad. You can only really help them shape a direction if you listen to what people don't like as well as what they do like. So I think that has come up a few times, obviously. And I think, you know, obviously I'm not going to bring too many examples up, but I think it comes with the increasing responsibility that consumers expect brands to have, whether that be food waste, whether that be, you know, mental health, as we mentioned before. And I think people expect more now, and I think it's important that brands, rather than putting out a glossy ad about something, they listen to what people are wanting and expecting, and they alter their behaviors accordingly. For example, you know, we've looked at things that around food wastage that show that, you know, by recipe marketing, which is incredibly effective, and a lot of brands do it really, really well, that actually, from the data we looked at, that looks like it increases food waste dramatically. So, because you're often that people are being encouraged to buy and try small bits of ingredients that they're never going to use again. So, I guess this is the kind of tension now between really good marketing and responsible marketing. And I think the only way brands can make sure that they kind of bridge that gap and make sure they're kind of working on both sides of that equation is by listening and hearing, you know, what people expect of them. So yeah, that does encourage conversations that maybe people don't want to hear sometimes, but you know, it is important that they hear them. And sometimes it might mean that people don't want to hear your opinion anymore, and you know, that has happened a couple of times as well. But that's, you know, I just think it's our responsibility as a business to tell people this is what people think. That could be about a creative idea, it could be about a campaign that's already gone out, it could be purely an attitudinal thing. But that's what we're there for, to tell people this is what people think. And you know, I don't mind if people don't want to hear it. It's the truth is the truth, ultimately.
And I guess that's where you know, companies like Jo Malone and PowAm will excel because they are open versus other companies that way continue to perhaps put their head in the sand, so to speak.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, sometimes it takes a while. And I think you know, that time will shorten, because I think the markets and industries will, you know, they've had a bit of a shock the last couple of months, and I think they're going to accelerate pretty rapidly once we come out of this. And I think people can't afford to be left behind anymore, and people will make those decisions based on A, who gets them, both from a lifestyle point of view, but also an ethical and values point of view as well. So again, it's a 3D problem for brands ultimately. So
Yeah.
I think it's important they have the right understanding before they put their foot on the accelerator again.
Makes sense. Well, I think we are close to the end of this podcast episode, but I just wanted to ask a couple of quick fire questions for
Sure.
you that I've asked all our other podcast participants. So, first question, what is the last thing you recommended to a friend or family member? So this could be like a TV show, a new band, a new recipe.
Actually, I just recommended to my wife actually that we watch a new box set that has just appeared, called McMillions. And it's basically about the fraud that was perpetuated, I think, in the 90s on the McDonald's Monopoly game.
Ah, yes, I have heard about it in this in another podcast, and it sounds like a really fascinating story of how they pulled that off.
Yeah, I'm also slightly obsessed with McDonald's because it was my first job when I was 16 and at school. So I did the archetypal McJob, and ever since then I've been quite interested in, I guess, their business model and all that kind of things. Really, it is a cultural phenomenon, but yeah, I just find it fascinating. It's got a lot of stories behind it, McDonald's.
Yes. And have you ever won anything via the Monopoly game before?
I think the best thing I've ever won is probably some medium fries. So I don't think I'm going to get caught up in any fraud investigation.
When I was a teenager, I actually won $50, I think,
Oh,
through
that's a
the
good haul.
yes. No, I was quite for a teenager. That's
Yeah.
the haul. So that was the most I ever won. No cars, no trips, but I could always say that I won $50. And the other question, what are you a fan of that may surprise most people? So this could be something like maybe you're a fan of professional wrestling or crocheting or
I think it's probably on the musical side. So I basically listen only to 90s grunge or I guess stoner metal, kind of this big sludgy rock music. And I think although obviously during the lockdown I've haven't had a haircut or shaved really, so I probably look more like that won't be a surprise to people now, but I think people are often surprised to see or to hear that that's what I listen to almost exclusively every day.
Yes.
If it was
Okay.
made after 1998, I don't really listen to it really.
You're not interested.
No, yeah.
All right. So, I mean, if people want to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
Probably email actually. I'm always open to chatting to anybody about anything really, whether it be, stoner metal, McDonald's, or understanding consumers. So yeah, my email is andrewweber@humantheory.co.uk, and I'm always very happy to chat to anyone.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew, for joining me today and talking about this, really rich and fascinating subject that I think, a lot of people may think they know about, but not necessarily know a lot of detail. And hopefully this, discussion with you has really opened up a few eyes.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And for everyone listening, if you want to follow Distillery on our socials, we are Distillery. So stay safe, wash your hands, and we look forward to welcome you to our next podcast soon.